so well that I can't even improve on what... When we think of a meeting between philosophy and institutionalized religion in any period of history, we are likely, as if by an involuntary association of ideas, to think at once of conflict. Philosophy and religion, it would seem, are ways of looking at the universe as too antagonistic to permit even an armistice, let alone peaceful cooperation. And indeed, the meeting of philosophy and religion in the Jewish Middle Ages did bring conflict in several spheres. In a strictly philosophical and theological sphere, that conflict expressed itself in what is known as the problem of reason and revelation, or faith and reason. The problem of reason and revelation itself contained at least two aspects. There was a conflict between differing methods of attaining the truth, and also a conflict between different bodies of doctrine resulting from the use of those methods. That is to say, there was a conflict between the method of attaining truth through the unaided exercise of human reason on the one hand, and the method of attaining truth through prophetic revelation on the other hand. And also a conflict between the body of doctrine drawn from Greek philosophy on the one hand and the body of doctrine drawn from the real religion on the other. Considerable attention has been paid by scholars to the problem of reason and revelation in the Middle Ages. The attention is justified, for the issue left its mark on the mentality of all whom it touched. It was, of course, a central concern for the philosophers themselves, but it was also a concern for thinking men who are not philosophers, yet who felt either a sympathetic interest or, more likely than not, an antipathetic interest in philosophy. Let's skip a bit. This is just an absolutely beautifully written thing, but we can't read it all. Let us begin by drawing a profile of the Jewish intellectual in the medieval period. He is someone who is sincerely religious, a sincere adherent to the religion of his fathers. He is, however, interested in ideas and open-minded. He is willing, even eager, to examine theoretical problems in an analytic, rationalist manner. Further, he is possessed of a medieval mentality in the following important sense. He has a completely static view of history. He cannot even imagine that people in biblical times and rabbinic times have looked at the universe differently from the way he looks at the universe. And by the same token, he never questions that the schools of Greek philosophy had achieved, definitively, once and for all, the most accurate description of the universe possible for the unaided human intellect. I want to trace how such a Jewish intellectual could analyze fundamental elements in the Jewish religion, and how, in each instance, his analysis could lead to the obligation of studying philosophy, to a religious obligation to study philosophy. The medieval thinker whose reasoning I'm going to trace is not a single individual, but a composite of several. In particular, Bakir ibn Bakuda, Abraham ibn Ezra, Abraham ibn David, Maimonides, and to a lesser degree, Saadia, Joseph ibn Sadiq, and Aldo. All the positions I'm going to present are quotations, paraphrases, or explications of these writers. Our composite medieval thinker is, to begin, certain that an essential, if not the most essential element in the Jewish religion, is the belief in the existence of God. Some scholars, of course, understand that in biblical times, people were so naive that they never questioned the existence of God. Whether or not that is true of biblical times, medieval thinkers were not so naive. Some modern theologians have, on the contrary, contended that a Jewish religion without a deity is possible and even desirable. Whether or not such a religion is indeed possible and desirable, medieval thinkers were not so sophisticated. For intelligent medieval Jew, it was obvious that the Jewish religion is meaningless. In fact, that Judaism as a whole is meaningless without a belief in the existence of God. But it was very far from obvious just what the belief in the existence of God might consist in. Just what belief consisted was one result of the meeting with Greek philosophy. And once the question is asked, there's a degree of inevitability in the way the medieval Jewish intellectuals answered. The medieval rationalist whom we are considering is careful to insist that belief in the existence of God cannot consist merely in saying something. Belief cannot, for example, consist in merely saying the words, God exists. The theory that belief consists merely in saying something had to be ruled out because certain Muslim theologians actually held that is all true belief does consist in. But for the medieval Jewish thinker, as for most men of intelligence, such belief would be worthless, if not paradoxical.
A person may say things he has not really thought about. A person can even be described as saying things he does not believe. Belief, therefore, clearly must consist in more than saying a few words. Once he is satisfied that belief must consist in more than saying something, our medieval Jewish intellectual proceeds to ask whether belief in the existence of God may consist in simply thinking something and having an opinion. Some beliefs surely do consist exclusively in thinking that something is so, but they are not necessarily true beliefs. A pauper, for example, may arbitrarily believe that he has money in his pocket. The man with a mortal enemy may arbitrarily believe that his enemy has died. But such beliefs are not merely false, they are foolish. And a religion based on beliefs of that type would be a religion of fools. The medieval Jews who thought about the question were sure that they required a much sounder foundation for their religion. They were sure that the only adequate basis for religion is a true and certain belief, a belief consisting not merely in thinking that something is so, but in knowing with certainty that it's so. In other words, an adequate belief in the existence of God, as demanded by the Jewish religion, must consist in true and certain knowledge of the existence of God. In the Middle Ages, several ways were recognized in which true and certain knowledge can be acquired, but there were only two recognized ways for ordinary people to acquire knowledge of the existence of God. Ordinary people, people who are not prophets or semi-prophets, can acquire knowledge of the existence of God either through reliable tradition or through rational demonstration. The medieval intellectual was thus faced with the necessity of adjudicating the relative value of these two sources of knowledge. Let's skip a little bit. The medieval rationalist whom we are following has then reached the stage in which he is sure that an adequate belief in the existence of God is a matter not merely as a cryptic for the tongue, but also for the heart. Adequate belief, furthermore, consists not merely in thinking that God exists, but in knowing that God exists. And the most adequate way of knowing God exists is by demonstrating the existence of God rationally to oneself. The train of reasoning, it should be added, closely followed Islamic models. Let's skip again a little bit in this excellent article. To summarize, on my page 289, his page 59, the composite medieval rationalists whose reasoning we have been following understands that adequate belief in the existence of God as required by religion must consist in true and certain knowledge of the existence of God. The best way to true and certain knowledge, and consequently the best way to adequate belief in the existence of God, is not through tradition, but through scientific demonstration. Therefore, in order to be adequate from a purely religious standpoint, belief required the study of the philosophical proofs of the existence of God. This position was reached through an analysis of the concept of belief and was supported by texts in scripture and rabbinic literature. It was the position of a line of medieval thinkers of different schools and different temperaments, but all having in common that they were sincerely religious and yet all rationalists. The point I've been making here, that medieval Jewish rationalists recognized an obligation to study philosophical proofs of the existence of God for purely religious reasons, can also be made with regard to the unity and incorporeability of God. Proper belief in God, from a strictly religious standpoint, is understood to include belief in his unity and incorporeality. An adequate belief in the unity and incorporeality of God, it was argued, must consist in true and certain knowledge. Such knowledge rests on the ability to demonstrate the unity of God. But instead of following the details of that train of reasoning, let us leave aside the cognitive side of religion and turn to another side of religion, the emotional side. I wish to consider the quality of love of God, unquestionably another essential element in religion. Love of God is prescribed by scripture, by rabbinic literature, and in the liturgy, and it was especially praised in the medieval literature as a religious virtue. Love is something that we suppose we intuitively understand, but when one stops to understand just what is meant by love, and just what love consists, it turns out to be a puzzling phenomenon. And it is particularly puzzling when the object of love is an invisible thing. The medieval thinkers whom we have been following did ask themselves what love of God should consist in, and they found that love of God presupposes knowledge of God. As one writer states, no one can experience the enormous love due to deity without knowing the object of his love. You cannot love something you do not know. The principle is far-reaching. To begin, it means that the existence of the object of love has to be known. You cannot love something if you do not know it exists. And so the very first step in analyzing the obligation to love the deity reinforces the result reached in analyzing the obligation to believe in the deity. Both require the study of whatever proofs there are of the existence of God. But love requires something more. simply knowing the existence of an object is still obviously not sufficient to inspire love on the part of any rational person. The nature of the proposed object of love must also be known. A sensible person loves an object only because he finds in it characteristics inspiring love. The emotional duty of loving God thus opens into a wide-ranging cognitive obligation, the obligation to acquire true and certain knowledge not only of the existence of God, but also, as far as possible, of the nature of God. Unfortunately, acquiring knowledge of the nature of God is not easy. In the Middle Ages, philosophers and non-philosophers alike agreed that the very essence of God is unknowable. All that can be known is a number of divine attributes. And knowledge of these attributes is necessarily limited, for such knowledge is both indirect and incomplete. The attributes of God can be known not in themselves, but only insofar they are reflected in what has come from God, in what God has said and done. For an examination of what God has said and done, one may infer what attributes God must have, always with the understanding that man can never reach the essence of God or the attributes of God in himself. Two sources of knowledge were recognized whereby ordinary people may learn what God has said and done. The same two sources of knowledge whereby man can acquire knowledge of the existence of God. First, such knowledge is possible through reliable tradition, the tradition crystallized in scripture and in literature. From God's recorded words and deeds, such attributes as goodness and wisdom can be inferred, and those attributes will inspire love of God. Second, the requisite knowledge is also available through a rational investigation of the physical universe. Many may discover what God has done by examining the physical universe, and from the handiwork they may learn of the Maker. From a rational investigation of the universe, such attributes of God as goodness and wisdom can again be inferred, and these attributes will again inspire love of God. Our medieval rationalists, as will be recalled, discovered drawbacks in knowledge based on tradition, and they determined that the better of the two sources of knowledge of the existence of God is human reasoning. By the same token, rational examination of the universe will be the better of the two sources of the knowledge of the attributes of God. The result of the love of God has now been plotted. Man loves God only through his knowledge of God. Man must begin with what God has said and done, that is to say, with an examination of the words of deeds of God in regard to the religious tradition, and with an examination of the deeds of God as discoverable by rational investigation of the physical universe. Studying the words and deeds of God will lead to knowledge of the attributes of God, and knowledge of the attributes of God will inspire love of God. It follows that only the man of knowledge can fulfill the obligation of loving God, and the greater the one's knowledge, the greater the love that will be inspired. Furthermore, since human reasoning is the more certain source of knowledge, special attention must be given to that source of knowledge of divine attributes. Knowledge of God's attributes to human reasoning is the high road, as it were, to the love of God. Let's skip a little bit. So, well, by his page 63. Well, maybe, let's go back a little bit to beginning of paragraph 4. Study of the holy law, the Torah, is another essential element in Jewish religion. Such study is prescribed by scripture, and for the ancient rabbis it was unquestionably the most important single human activity. The rabbis vigorously opposed the study of subjects other than the law, including a subject that they called, quote, Greek wisdom. And their opposition stemmed not merely from a fear of heretical opinions, it stems equally from concern about the loss of time that would result. All available time should, according to the rabbis, be devoted to a single discipline, the study of God's written and oral law, and therefore the study of anything else was forbidden as a misuse of time. The medieval thinker whom we are following therefore had to ask himself whether his growing attachment to philosophy could harmonize with the religious obligation to study only the Torah. When the medieval rationalist began to consider the religious duty of studying the law, he found that duty itself problematic. In the Middle Ages, as in rabbinic times, the study of the law was generally understood to consist of the study of the intricacies of rituals, torts, marriage law, and the like. But common sense would suggest that if study is indeed a religious virtue, then there are other, perhaps more important things to study. There seemed, for example, to be at least as much religious value in pursuing a course of study leading to the knowledge of God and of God's working in the universe. The medieval Jewish thinker was both an adherent of the Jewish religion and also of a rationalist temperament, would then be faced with a dilemma. on the one hand, exclusive attention to the divine laws prescribed by the authoritative sources of Jewish religion. On the other hand, common sense suggests that pursuing the knowledge of God and God's workings has at least as much religious value as the studying the ritual and civil law, even God-given ritual and civil law. Certain medieval intellectuals found a solution to the dilemma within the authoritative religious sources themselves. For while the ancient rabbis did indeed insist that only the divine law is worthy of study, the rabbis at the same time conceived of the law as much wider than a corpus of civil and ritual obligations. In addition to strictly legal subjects, the law, according to ancient rabbis, includes other subjects. Specifically, it includes theological subjects. The terms used in rabbinic literature with regard to theological study are of interest here. They are pardes, the pleasure garden, ma'aseh breshit, the account of creation, and ma'aseh merkavah, the account of the chariot. Precisely what these three terms originally represented is impossible to determine. We, however, are interested not in what they originally signified, but what rather in the way they were understood by our medieval rationalists. The well-known Talmudic account of the four who entered the pleasure garden was in the Middle Ages widely taken to refer to an esoteric doctrine. The rabbinic sources have also stressed the dangers lurking, as it were, in the pleasure garden. Still, inasmuch as Rabbi Akiva had been described as an adept therein, and having entered in peace and come out in peace, the esoteric doctrine in question was taken to be highly approved for all who were properly qualified. The only theological subject recognized by a rationalist is philosophical or scientific theology, what is today called natural theology. Furthermore, the philosophers in the Middle Ages, it so happened, did regard philosophy as an esoteric subject, to be pursued only by the properly qualified. It was thus natural for medieval rationalists surmise that the pleasure garden sanctioned by the Talmudic rabbis was a philosophic study of the nature of God. A rational analysis of the account of creation and the account of chariot led further. Both the account of creation and the account of the chariot have been expressly included by the ancient rabbis within the holy law taken in the broad sense. The study of them was sanctioned as part of the general obligation to study the law. Furthermore, a well-known passage in the Talmud offers an evaluation of one of the two. The passage in question compares the account of the chariot with ordinary legal disputations, and it describes intricate legal disputations as only a small matter, in contrast to the account of the chariot, which it characterizes as a great matter. Thus, the two areas of theological study under consideration have not only been sanctioned as part of the study of the law, at least one of the two have been rated as a subject of study far superior to merely legal disputations. As for the original content, nothing was known in the Middle Ages, just as virtually nothing is known today. It was known only that the account of creation was an esoteric interpretation of the creation story of the book of Genesis, and the account of the chariot was an esoteric interpretation of the divine chariot and vision of the prophet Ezekiel. Anything further was, and still is, conjecture, to answer Dr. Schwab. Yet, there is an obvious direction for the conjecture of a medieval rationalist to take. The account of creation was, in effect, a rabbinic description of the manner in which God constructed the physical universe. And the account of the chariot was, in effect, a rabbinic description of the structure reached an out of the structure where is it?
Of the divine realm, 64. Yeah,
that's right. Of the divine realm, the realm standing behind the physical universe. Now, a systematic description of the physical universe is what is known as the science of physics, and a systematic description of the structure of the invisible realm is what is known as the science of metaphysics. It was therefore natural to infer that the ancient rabbinical account of creation contained a rabbinic science of physics, and the ancient rabbinic account of the chariot contained a rabbinic science of metaphysics. To replace the lost rabbinic sciences, recourse had to be had to other sources. And indeed, a reliable science of physics and of metaphysics, in fact, the most reliable science of physics and metaphysics that could ever be produced through unaided human reason was available. Greek philosophy offered those sciences. It followed that the only source now available for those who wished to fulfill the religious duty of study at its highest level, at the level of the account of the chariot, was Greek philosophy.
on a priori grounds or medieval rationalists thus found that the religious obligation to study must include more than merely legal subjects. The knowledge of God and knowledge of God's working in the universe are surely appropriate objects of religious study. The study of philosophy was not, however, then recommended in opposition to the old injunction to study the holy law. On the contrary, the study of philosophy was recommended as an integral part of the study of the law. In fact, Greek philosophy, it ironically turned out, provided the only available means for fulfilling the obligation of studying the law at the very highest level recognized by the ancient rabbis themselves. This result confirmed and reinforced the results reached when our medieval rationalists analyzed the religious obligation to believe in the existence of God and the religious obligation to love God. He analyzed the religious obligation to believe in the existence of God, and he found that obligation could be properly fulfilled only through knowledge of proofs of the existence of God. He analyzed the religious obligation to love God, and he found that obligation could be fulfilled only through a knowledge of the science of physics and the science of metaphysics. He further analyzed the obligation to study the law, and that obligation, too, he found, can be fulfilled only through studying the science of physics and metaphysics. It is well known, of course, that some medieval thinkers approved of the study of Greek philosophy. I'm not making that point. The point I've been attempting to make is a different one. Given medieval Jewish thinkers who were faithful adherents of the religion of their fathers and yet of a rationalist temperament, to these men, religious obligations could make sense only when analyzed and understood in a rational manner. For them, only a rationalized religion was a satisfactory religion, and thus the study of philosophy became necessary on religious grounds. The study of philosophy itself became a religious obligation. And I think that that's an excellent presentation of the position of the stream of the Jewish rationalists. But, as we have seen, it was just not merely the rationalists who felt that the study of the Talmud was only of preparatory or secondary importance. It was also the leaders of the Kabbalah, the Kabbalists. And the thrust of Professor Katz's article is to describe how, in fact, that shift began to take place over the ages, and that will be something that we will take up in the continuation of this. But I think that before we do that, we should make at least some attempt to go back and understand possible sources for the notion of study as a religious obligation as it existed in Talmudic times, because after all, this in and of itself is a remarkable phenomenon. And on that matter, I have to, we should go through and see what the viewpoints of experts on the subject are. And the only expert whom I really have some confidence in this is Professor Bickerman. Here, I'm going to have to rely on him to a great extent because I'm incapable of actually reading the Greek texts and the Egyptian texts and the Persian texts and all of the literature that he quotes. So we will take up Professor Bickerman's article in Yitzhak next week, but there I'm on much less sure footing. So it's in here.
Is it in English?
It is in English, and it's in there. And it's from his excellent book that I keep recommending all the time. It's a book that's available at the Harvard University Press called The Jews in the Greek Age. And as I say, this is not a subject in which I can speak from any personal knowledge. That is, everything that I've said this evening, even though I was reading to you what Professor Davidson wrote, is just because he expressed himself so well that I can't improve on his exposition. But everything that he said was something that I knew from my own reading of the sources. But when we take up the prehistory of the notion of study, I'll just briefly explain. Professor Bickerman's point is an analysis of the phrase sofrim. In the Mishnah and in the Gemara, of course, we talk about dinei sofrim, takanat sofrim. Who were the sofrim? Who, in fact, were the scribes? What is it? We from Josephus, we know the story that the, or from other sources, from the Gemara, we know that there are the Kushim and the Tzidkim and the Isiim. These are sects. But who were the sofrim? By the time of the Gemara, the
Chazal did not call themselves Sofrim, and in fact the Gemara in Kiddushin tries to reconstruct the meaning of the phrase Sofrim, that they would count the number of letters in the Torah. Remember when we were studying that a couple of years ago? But obviously that's not the original meaning of the word Sofrim. Professor Bickerman's point was that the Sofrim represented an estate, if I can use the French term, that is, a class of technocrats who had developed because of the emergence of a universal administration, first in Aramaic and then in Greek, and that these became the leaders. And well, I'll leave you to read Professor Bickerman's article, and as an interesting reflection of Professor Bickerman's chapter, it was written 20 or 30 years ago, I've also appended a very recent article in the latest issue of Daedalus dealing with the rise of the philosophy of the Enlightenment, also from the creation of a novel class of people, of technocrats and bureaucrats, because of the creation of the absolute state in France by Professor Beeson. So you can try to look at both of these articles and compare them to one another. I, of course, will be on very shaky grounds because all of these are sort of essays in the sociological origins of various beliefs, and they're much less susceptible to firm argumentation, especially not for me because I'm not in possession of the knowledge of the rest of the world. So our object for the next couple of weeks will be first to sort of try to summarize Professor Bickerman's position, and then come back to Professor Katz's article and see how the Mekubalim actually also displace the study of Gemara from their scheme of things as being pushed it down lower on their scale of values, and also felt that the primary object of study should be the study of direct study of God through the study of Kabbalah. And then the final irony, which was revolution in conceptual thought introduced by Reb Chaim Golozhin, which Professor Katz briefly mentions at the end of the article. So this will occupy us for the next couple of weeks.